It's the next year green on podtech.net. I'm Matt Kelly. I'm joined here today by Chelsea Sexton of Who Killed the Electric Car fame and also Plug in America. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am, you know, your completely normal average girl next door, the most unlikely person in the world to be doing anything like this. Definitely never expected to be in a movie. I play with cars. I mean, that's what I do, and it's what I've been doing for 15 years.
You're a car chick.
I am. I'm a bit of a gearhead.
Oh, my gosh.
Never was into cars till I started working with them, and then got completely sucked in.
You actually started working for Saturn at age 17.
I did. I was a bit of a geek, graduated high school a little early, and after my first year of college, needed to buy a car, so I bought a Saturn. Mm-hmm. And they said, would you like to come work here? Mm. And, you know, my family would describe me as sort of pathologically self-sufficient. And so I took the job as a way to pay for college. I did not want my parents paying for my college education.
Wow.
I wanted to do it myself and all that. So that's why I started selling cars. It was purely for that reason. And a few years later, the EV1 came along and they handed it to Saturn for marketing, and I got completely sucked into that program.
Mm. Did you grow up here in Southern California?
I did, actually. I'm an LA native, and I have mostly lived in a little bitty town that is ironically named after the oil refinery that forms its southern border.
Mm.
So it's very much a little Mayberry kind of place.
Do you think that, you know, Southern California is a car culture. It really is.
Very
so do you think that really influenced your love of the automobile?
You know, it's possible. I mean, we are so much, you know, passion. We have so much passion around the automobile and the freedom and everything that suggests that it could very much be sort of subconsciously about that. But really, I got sucked into the technology.
Mm.
I mean, I came at it geek first.
Mm.
And environment and everything else second, actually.
Mm.
And so that was what I was really drawn to, was just the pure technology of it and wanting to understand how it worked and all of that.
Mm.
Only afterwards, you know, driving them. I mean, they're definitely fun to drive, and you get sucked into that part too. And, you know, being able to take a Viper off the line is really fun. I don't care whether you're into cars or not. But I was not a car person initially. I mean, I bought my first one purely just to get from A to B, and just a normal, practical little Saturn. I mean, it wasn't out there looking for something real gearhead.
What initially attracted you to Saturn as a brand? You know, there's tons of cars out there,
right. But
you gravitated towards Saturn, obviously, for some reason.
Sure. I mean, it was in the very beginning of when that little company was formed, and it was still that very much, you know, hometown, no haggling, barbecues every month.
The alternative car, in a sense, to what was the norm.
Absolutely. I mean, I obviously needed an economical little car. I wasn't looking for anything fancy. The fact that it was American was great. I liked that it was a new company. I mean, we as Americans tend to embrace the underdog a little bit, and they were at that time.
Right?
They were the new unproven one.
Mm-hmm.
And just the atmosphere of the place. They're very sincere and enthusiastic, and, you know, walking in, especially as a fairly young girl, to buy a car was not this overwhelming experience. So, and same thing working for them. I don't think I could have sold cars or worked for any other car company, at least initially, but that lack of pressure. And they're sort of, they've always embraced the individual. So you didn't have to be sort of the classic, you know, middle-aged white guy addicted to coffee and cigarettes to sell their cars. So, I mean, that was, all of those things drew me to it.
So you bought the car, and then they invited you to come work for them, and what did you do for them?
I initially sold cars.
As a salesperson?
As a salesperson.
As an 18 or 19-year-old young woman selling cars?
Yes.
Quite a... I mean, breaking the mold in a sense, really. You know, you go into your regular car dealership today, and like you say, it's probably a middle-aged white guy that's trying to, you know, be a little pressure-oriented to sell you a car.
Sure.
So,
I mean, it was an interesting experience. I became the underdog. I mean, I was a woman in the car industry. I was a really young girl in the car industry. I wasn't yet old enough to vote when I went to work for. And, you know, there were certain people that would not give me the time of day, no question. And then there were others that very much, you know, other women liked working with me because I was even lower pressure than the guys that were there and that sort of thing. So,
how did you do?
I did well, actually. I eventually earned the nickname Chelsea Van Damme, so I have to think I did okay.
Nice, nice. And then the EV1 came along.
Yes.
changed your life.
Totally. Totally changed it. Yeah, I mean, the EV1 came out, or it was about to come out, and it's the only car in GM's history that just has the little blue GM badge on it. It's not a Chevy or a Saturn or anything else. But there's no such thing as a GM dealer, just a GM dealer. And so they had to hand it to a brand to market. And they picked Saturn less because of who they thought the customers would be, but more because of our reputation for bringing a new product to market and customer service and that sort of thing. They decided that was better than going with, say, Cadillac, that might have fit more with who they expected the buying demographic to be.
Talk a little bit first about the genesis of the vehicle. There's probably some in our audience that don't know why this vehicle was made in the first place.
Sure. I mean, it started as a concept car, like, you know, every other concept car that all the automakers make every year for the round of auto shows. And it was originally called the Impact. GM, a few years before in the late 80s, had participated in, of all things, a solar race in Australia and won it by 2.5 days. Just absolutely, you know...
Do you think they were surprised by that?
Oh, I'm sure they were surprised by it. But they also started to think, well, maybe there's something to this whole electric drive thing. And this would make a cool concept car, and let's make an electric vehicle. And so they did, and they brought it to the LA Auto Show in 1990. And Roger Smith rolled it out, and it got this amazing response. And a few months later, he was back at the National Press Club and on Earth Day, of all things. And he goes, you know, I think we're going to make this thing. Much to the chagrin of most of the people he worked with. They kind of went, wait a minute. You know, we weren't actually planning to build it. It was just a concept car.
And he was head of GM.
And he was the chairman at the time of General Motors. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, the irony, of course, is that, you know, Roger and me made him a very different man than the, you know, role he played in this particular vehicle and its program, because it would not have come about had it not been for Roger.
Hmm.
No question. And the whole time, the California Air Resources Board was watching this process, going, you know, we've been looking for an answer to our air quality problems. This, I think, is it. And now that you've announced that you might do this, we're going to lay down this mandate that all of the big automakers do this if they want to keep doing business in the state of California. So they created this law in late 1990 that said if you want to sell cars here, 10% of all vehicles you offer for sale by 2003 have to be zero emission. And it started a little earlier. It started at 2% in 98, and it kind of ramped up, so it wasn't this all at once thing. And the moment the law came about, the automaker started fighting it.
Do you think that that was the death knell of the car, is the actual mandate? And had the mandate not been enacted, that maybe the car actually might have survived a little bit longer?
I mean, we hear that a lot, that if you really wanted these cars to come, you shouldn't have, you know, the law shouldn't have come about, and it was the law that killed them. I don't think that was the case, not least because soon after he announced that car, Roger retired. And I'm not sure that those who followed him would have continued. I think Roger Stempel would have. He was the immediate successor. But I'm not sure Jack Smith would have let that car come. And he was who was actually on guard by the time it did finally come to market. So I think that car probably would have died out anyway. Just my own personal feeling about, you know, GM. And, I mean, it's not just, it's any car company. They're all a company of factions. And their interests change depending on who's in power and what the market looks like and all these different variables. So it's impossible to assign one opinion to an entire company.
Mm-hmm.
Although for simplicity of the story, we tend to have to. And eventually someone is allowed to make a decision on behalf of the entire company, so you can hold that company responsible for that opinion. But, you know, it was a bunch of different things. There's actually a whole book that was written about the car and its creation. It's called The Car That Could, and it's fascinating because this Vanity Fair reporter was given unprecedented access to a car company from soup to nuts when that car first came about, and it leaves off right before we were all hired and the car came to market. And you read it and you go, my God, it's amazing that car ever appeared at all, for all the fits and starts and stops and all the different things that went along the way. And this happens on every car program. We just, as a buying public, don't tend to see it.
And I think that's actually, you know, one thing that is rather interesting about cars in general is people go to their neighborhood dealership and think, A, that that's the car company, and yet it's a wholly separate business, and they have no real idea about what it takes to make a car.
Right.
I was fortunate to actually go to the Lansing Delta Township plant in Lansing, Michigan, to watch them build the new Saturn Outlook and the Buick Enclave and GMC Acadia, and I was thinking, oh, great, it's another plant tour. I was fascinated.
Yeah.
Because, again, I think there's this disconnect about what goes into making a vehicle.
Oh, absolutely. And even the people making it. I mean, we found a lot of disconnects. We'd go to, I mean, the EV one was also built in Lansing in a different facility, the Lansing Craft Center. And we'd go there, and that was a little, tiny car line. I mean, it was 8 stations, no conveyors, very hand-built. And we would talk to these people who were incredibly passionate about that car. They loved it like I do. Mm. But even they didn't quite understand. They said, God, do you think anyone will actually want to lease this thing? Do you think anyone will want one out in California? Because they're back in snowy Michigan, where it was not the most practical car for the winter. This little 2-seat aerodynamic car with whose range would go down in cold weather and that kind of thing. And they just, as much as they loved it, there was that, will anyone else like it like we do? I mean, it was even within the company perceived as this little geeky thing that may not have a market to it.
And it was really only released in 2 markets, wasn't it? I mean, California and Arizona.
Right, yeah. We sent a few dozen to Georgia and Florida and a few other spots, but they were only available to the public in those 2 states. And not even all of those 2 states. California, you know, partially because of the mandate, but also weather. I mean, especially with the original lead-acid batteries, it needed to be in warm weather. And certainly we were testing them in markets where people would be a little bit more, you know, environmentally minded and a little bit more accepting of early issues and that sort of thing. It was aimed at early adopters initially, for sure.
Was it throughout the whole state of California, or was it primarily the Southern California market?
We started just in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Eventually it made it to Sacramento and San Francisco and the rest of it through about the next year.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the first edition of the car, lead-acid batteries.
Right.
There were some problems with them.
Oh, no question. I mean, it's like any other early product. I mean, they definitely had some infant issues, particularly with the batteries, which were solved by a different brand of batteries later on.
Mm-hmm.
But no question, early on, they had the same sort of bugginess that the first iPods or any other high-tech gadget had.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the specialists, which were the sort of people that were hired to take over once the car was built, were very active in that process, not just leasing the car, but, you know, when you leased a car, you got my home phone number for 2 years, or 3 years, or however long you had the car. And people used them. They'd call at midnight if they had a question. And, you know, we would take care of it. So, you know, that hand-holding, that customer service that Saturn was known for was key to the introduction of something like this, because it was a fishbowl product. The world was watching, and that was very much instilled on us. If it succeeds or fails, it's on the shoulders of the 13 of you that are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, especially being young and in our 20s and kind of dared that you can't possibly make this succeed, we were that much more bent on doing it. I mean, we were stubborn in every way about making this a success. And that absolutely carried over into handling all of those little early issues. Because early adopters will be very forgiving of stuff, but only if it's handled really well when it comes up. And
as long as they have customer support, in a sense.
Yeah,
you know, they're willing
to be honest about it. And when you don't know, you say you don't know. And, and most people are quite reasonable about
that. And this is really even before the advent of the internet in terms of, you know, logging on to try to get, you know, a support group to help solve.
Right. It was just starting. We did have it. And there was an owner's club that formed right away. You know, sort of very objectively, this group, the group of drivers of the EV1, became known as the most passionate driving group ever. I mean, it made Saturn people look mellow. And it was amazing. So they formed this owner's club and these email lists, and they would exchange, you know, fixes and technical tips and stuff on their own, and they developed, you know, all kinds of things, charging networks and road rallies and monthly club meetings and merchandise. And I mean, they had their own checking accounts with a picture of the car on their check. They could not have been more into all of this, which, you know, we, of course, loved. You know, just that passion. It matched our own. It was the first time I've ever seen the buyer of a product or the user of a product have a level of passion that matched those of us that were involved.
It's interesting in a sense when you kind of talk about some of this, because I would think in a sense that General Motors or other maybe secondary entities would have realized a marketing opportunity for merchandise.
Yeah.
Now you see it, you know, ad infinitum with vehicles.
We had a bunch of merchandise, but none of it, we didn't really sell it. I mean, we made jackets for the drivers, and, and you know, we of course had it on everything from luggage to coffee mugs, but they tended not to do a lot of selling of it. In fact, the one thing that was still, it's to this day, the one piece of merchandise that everybody wishes they had was a Hot Wheel. Everyone wants an EV1 Hot Wheel.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I'm an avid collector of Matchboxes and Hot Wheels. The old ones, though. But if
too.
There was a new one of that or something, I probably would.
Me too. And the head designer of Hot Wheels actually had an EV1 for a while. And, you know, they really wanted to make one. And GM kind of kiboshed the idea. They said no. But, you know, absolutely people want those sorts of things.
I look at the vehicle, and I had the good fortune to actually tour the GM Heritage Center in Michigan, Sterling Heights. And I was surprised at two things about it. First of all, the European style of it. It looks like a Citroën to me. You know, I look at that and I'm like, it looks like a French car.
Yeah.
A French-designed auto automobile. And then the second one, and this was really strange for me, and I don't know if anyone has ever mentioned it to you, but one of the silver ones was there, and I think it was the silver Impact, in fact. And I looked at the front fascia, the front of the vehicle, and it looked like an alien to me.
Yeah.
You know, like one of those gray, you know, big eyes and big mouth aliens or something like that. Has anyone ever said that?
Well, I've heard a lot of things about it. I don't think I've ever heard it called an
alien.
It's
like now you're going to go, you know, look at the picture and be like, oh, now I know what he's talking about.
Oh, so. I absolutely know what you're talking about. I want to say it, sure. Now, I mean, it was an interesting design because it was designed with no customer input. I mean, it was given to this team and it was designed largely in a wind tunnel. It's the most aerodynamic production car ever made, and it was done entirely with that in mind. So it wasn't something where they put it in front of customers and said, what do you think? You know, should we tweak this, smooth that? It was all about aerodynamics. And so it was, the rear wheels were closer together in the back, and it had the wheel skirts that would cover up half the wheels, like the Insight does now. And there were a bunch of those sorts of things about it. There was no radio antenna, because someone figured out that it would cut 1 mile off your range. And so they integrated the radio antenna into the roof of the car. You know, initially, no one thought that it would need a front license plate because that would cut aerodynamics. I mean, all of these different things were all, you know, done solely for that reason. Efficiency, aerodynamics, because that has such an effect on range. Weight and high drag are the enemy of range in a battery electric car. So the teams were given, you know, it's a number of grams to work with. I mean, it was really carefully calibrated, and it's amazing. It's part of the reason the car came out as good as it did, was because it was designed purposely for, you know, just for this. It wasn't a conversion of a different vehicle.
What carried over from that vehicle? Here you're talking about the aerodynamics and everything. Can you, you know, fast forward now to 15 years later or 10 years later or whatever, to say you can directly correlate something in a vehicle today to that vehicle?
Oh, sure. I mean, there were a bunch of systems that were pioneered on the EV1 and for the other companies, their electric vehicles. I mean, a lot of it was, some of it was stuff you normally think of, regenerative braking that are in hybrids now that all came off electric cars, and some of it's really normal stuff. You know, the tire pressure monitoring system in that car is used on other ones today. You know, brake-by-wire, drive-by-wire, all of these sorts of systems that are now in regular cars, lightweight materials, different aerodynamic ideas came off of the EV1. Lots of patents, lots of innovative ideas that are now in what we think of as advanced technology or alternative fuel cars, hybrids and the like, but they're also in regular gasoline cars today to help make them lighter and more efficient, or in some ways just nicer features in general.
In the movie Who Killed the Electric Car, I was under the impression that some of these vehicles actually got sold. Is that correct, or were they all strictly leased?
All of the EV1s were leased. There were a handful, comparatively, of other electric vehicles that were sold.
Okay.
A few RAV4s were sold for Toyota. A few Chevy S10s and Ford Rangers were sold. But the vast majority of all of them were leased.
No EV1s or Impacts were ever sold?
No. Lease only.
That's a disappointment. So the vehicle came out, and the owners who had the four, and I won't say the owners, the lessees.
I know, we call them owners, too.
I've been corrected by someone in the EV1 community very vociferously, and I think we know who we're talking about, about that, that we weren't owners. The lessees of the vehicle were very happy with them. How many totally were produced? 800, is that correct?
Well, there were about 1,100 produced, and about 800 of them made available for lease. The rest were demos and used from crash testing and different things like that.
As I, again, watched the movie, it looked to me that a significant portion of the lessees were pretty well-known people. I hate to use the word celebrities,
right.
But was that a conscious decision to try to get these in the hands of people who had a higher profile maybe than the average American?
Well, it's an interesting thing, and it's a line we walk, because of the total, actually very few were high profile in any way. I mean, most of them were actually quite average people.
Okay.
And early on, there was no significant effort one way or the other. It was just whoever had interest, and some of those people happened to be celebrities, and some didn't. I mean, that was very simple. As the program started to be pulled back, and as we as specialists and people in the program that were passionate about it tried to keep it going, a couple things happened. One, we tried to bring attention to it. I mean, really had this thought of, part of it, we gave GM the benefit of the doubt. They just don't understand. And then as it became clear that they did fully understand people wanted this car, and they fully didn't want to be part of this program, and started to pull it back, we thought, if we can just bring enough attention to it, we can sort of make them get behind their own product. You know, the state obviously doesn't realize there's more demand for these cars than the automakers are letting on. The media hasn't caught on. I mean, a lot of it was an effort just to get the story told. And so we certainly did, I don't know if we sought out celebrities necessarily, but we certainly capitalized on those who had that interest. And then the other part was, once we started running low on cars and there were very few to be had, we had to make a case for everybody to whom we wanted to lease a vehicle, and quite simply, the celebrities won. I mean, the third grade science teacher didn't really hold that much attractiveness for GM, but somebody like Mel Gibson would. And I think there was a little bit of a double-edged sword there. On one hand, I think some of them wanted the good press that would come out of a celebrity driving your car, and I think there was a little bit of anxiety about the potential with which a celebrity had the option to scream if they didn't get one. I mean, someone that was on TV every week certainly could make a big deal if you denied them a car.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a little bit of both.
Mm. So talk about then the demise of the vehicle on the corporate level. Where do you think that came to be? What was the genesis of it? Do you think it was Jack Smith who finally said, kill this car? Or here you've talked again, you know, the people were interested in it, and it worked.
Right. Well, I think it's hard to hold one person responsible,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think Jack would have been it either. I mean, Jack also left mid-program.
Mm-hmm.
There were a bunch of people involved, and again, it goes back to that factions. There are people in that company that to this day love that car like I do, and there are people that even back then never wanted to see it happen. And we talk a little bit about the car guys versus the bean counters and, you know, the difference.
But, I mean, any auto manufacturer is, A, beholden to shareholders, and they want to sell cars.
Sure.
That's what they want to do.
I know.
So, I mean, if there's demand for it, they would have built it and have mass-produced it.
Well,
so,
and that's the that is the surface observation. I mean, that is really, when you look at it, what it appears. If they could have made money, they would have built them. Ergo, it must not have had any potential for success. And it became about much more than that. I mean, there were all these different layers to why they would or would not want to get into that program. And part of it was, well, what does selling this do to our gas cars? I mean, that was probably the most intangible challenge for them to sort of address, was if we sell an electric car and its merits, it's clean, it's quiet, it doesn't pollute, all of these different things, it inherently makes all the rest of our vehicles look bad by comparison. It makes a Suburban look dirty. It, you know, all of these sorts of things. And when your core product is large cars, trucks, and SUVs, and you make lots of money on some of them, it's very difficult to really embrace the idea of this, where even if you sell a lot, if you're making less money per car, if you're making less money in parts and service, it may not be such a good idea compared to what you're doing. And part of it was, you know, humans are afraid of change.
Mm.
Even within this company, people tend to think of, well, what's this going to do to my career?
Mm.
If it fails, what's it going to do to my career? If my other car program starts to decline because of enthusiasm for this new technology, what is it going to do to my retirement? Or, you know, really basic things where sometimes it wasn't a mass effort within a company. There's no conspiracy necessarily, but sometimes just one person making a decision and people not questioning it. And then you have a few of those people scattered around, and it takes on a momentum of its own if people don't raise their hand and say, wait a minute, why are we doing this? And there were parts and service considerations. Dealers make lots of profit on parts and service, and here's a car that really didn't need very much of either one. There are no oil changes, no spark plugs, very little regular maintenance, that sort of thing. I mean, there were all sorts of tweaks to the traditional business model that would have had to be done. Not insurmountable ones, no question. It all could have been done. But, you know, at a basic level, when the status quo is really attractive, you try to protect that status quo.
Well, GM Goodwrench is a large portion of the revenues of GM as a bottom line.
Absolutely.
So this certainly would have a negative impact on it. One of the things that, while you were speaking of this, it brought it home to me. I have a friend who has designed this thing called a chill pack,
mm-hmm.
and it sits under your laptop. Well, you can't call them laptops anymore
because
they're so small and compact that they get so hot that they actually burn you. And he was in negotiations with Apple to have Apple buy his company and offer that with all their notebooks, but then that got kiboshed because the company realized that if we offer this, then it's basically saying that, yes, our laptops run too hot.
Right.
And so the man lost out on millions of dollars.
Absolutely.
But I would imagine that it's the same type of scenario in a sense that if they had sold this vehicle, it would be an admission that all their other vehicles are dirty and polluting, and who wants that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a concern. It's funny because I look at it and say, it was manageable. It was not that big a deal. And it wasn't, at no point were any of us, even the most enthusiastic, trying to suggest you all should be driving electric cars.
Mm.
It was more about providing choice to the people who wanted them and in multiple configurations. I mean, electric drive can go into an SUV as well or a truck. And there should be gas cars, hybrids, electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, all these different sorts of things so that people themselves can make the choice of what works for them.
Well, and so you bring up an interesting point because there is still a lot of controversy around this vehicle by the naysayers who say, oh, it was only a two-seater, so, you know, why would I want to drive that? Or it only went, you know, so far in range and, you know, I travel more than that in a day, et cetera, et cetera.
I know, it's funny because we hear it all the time back then and still, it's not the car for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not. There's not a single gas car on the road today that's the car for everybody.
I drive a 1991 Mazda Miata. It's not for everybody.
No, and by that token, neither is a Tahoe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no one car that meets that particular parameter. And yet, for some reason, we hold alternate fuel cars to that standard. I'm not sure why.
Mm.
And it's funny because the EV1, there were about half a dozen different production electric cars available, and the EV1 was the only two-seater. We had a couple pickup trucks, we had a couple SUVs, we had a station wagon, and yet, maybe because it was the most sort of iconic, we all tend to think of electric cars as just little bitty two-seater cars, and that's all they can ever be.
Mm-hmm.
And so you hear a lot of that. Well, it doesn't meet my needs.
Right.
Okay, so don't buy one. But it might meet your neighbor's needs.
Right.
Or, you know, it might have, you know, the car that had 60 miles of range when we started had 140 when it was killed.
Mm.
It would have 300 today. I mean, these things do get better, just as iPods now store 80 gigs instead of their initial 15 or whatever it was.
Right.
So it's an interesting phenomenon that we tend to think of what's today is never going to get any better. And that was absolutely assigned to that technology.
So why do you think GM crushed the vehicles? They could have done what Ford or Toyota did and actually sold them all off, in a sense, more or less washing their hands of them, saying, hey, you're on your own for service and things like that. But they actually repossessed all of them and crushed them.
Right. And to be fair, Ford and Toyota and the rest did the same with every one of them they could.
Mm-hmm.
All of the automakers took back all the vehicles that were leased and even some that were sold if the owners would give them up and crushed them. It was not just a GM thing. But across the board, I think the reason it was done was primarily because they were their own best advertisement. The more they were on the road, the more people wanted them. And there was this, you know, it sounds pretty heavy-handed to say they wanted to get rid of the evidence, but there was a little bit of that.
Mm.
There were all kinds of other reasons that they gave at the time, and as we debunked each one of them, they'd go to a different reason. But the reality was, you know, it would take an hour to go to 7-Eleven because you'd come out of the store and there would be a crowd around your car and people saying, how can I get one of these?
Mm.
So if you don't want to be in that business, growing demand is a liability.
Mm.
And at some point you have to, you know, contain that liability. And I think that getting rid of the cars was the easiest way to do it.
Do you think the vehicle was ahead of its time?
For a mass market, it was. I mean, I don't think that in general the vehicle was ahead of its time. It certainly is a more attractive prospect today. I mean, gas back then was $1.50 a gallon. you know, national security and domestic energy and global warming hadn't really hit the radar screen. It was seen much more as an environmental issue and an air quality issue back then. What's ironic is that the enviros were the smallest group of people that actually leased the car, but it was definitely perceived that way. And it still had a good little niche market back then. And it's funny because GM, for better or worse, made the, maybe the mistake of putting down for us early on their break-even numbers. And
can you share that?
No, probably not.
So you bring up something. Are you still beholden to a non-disclosure?
Well, everybody signed different agreements, and I mean, it goes to a larger issue even as we've tried to tell this story. I think that it's fair to protect proprietary information, and I think that there are still, you know, 90% of the story has yet to be told, and some of it may never be, partially because of stuff like that, but partially because it's not as important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some things...
But I think that's an actual important point, is that break-even point.
I think so, too. And I've never heard it publicly disclosed by someone at GM.
But do you know it?
I do know it. I think it would be considered proprietary.
You do, okay. Because oftentimes, when I do interviews with some car people, particularly as it relates to a new vehicle or something, I ask that question. And, you know, all the time.
Right.
They don't disclose it.
Right.
But you know that each car company does have that number.
Oh, sure.
It's written down somewhere to say, we have to sell this many cars
absolutely.
In order for it to be a success. Well, that's why they killed the Oldsmobile.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't making that number.
Right.
You know, so...
And, you know, the interesting thing about it is it's a lower number than anyone would suspect.
Hmm.
I mean, there's no question there. And I don't think for that reason that that is why they killed the car. It wasn't because they couldn't sell enough in a year to
mm-hmm.
make it profitable,
mm-hmm.
because they absolutely could have.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes to other reasons. But, you know, certainly there is information in all of this that they would consider to be proprietary. And part of the line we walk is to get the story out there without inviting any more liability on ourselves than we have to.
Mm. So, in a sense, do you feel that you are walking a little bit of a line here to not draw the scrutiny of General Motors for possible liability in what you might say?
Not so much anymore.
Mm.
It was a consideration, I would say, years ago,
mm.
and I think I've already drawn whatever scrutiny I'm going to draw, basically.
Okay.
And I tend to, much to the chagrin maybe of my family, I tend to live like nobody's watching. So I don't go out of my way to say, here, you know, sue me for this. And I certainly try not to, you know, invite it more than I have to,
mm-hmm.
but I don't really live in fear. You
yeah.
know, the various
no,
threats
good,
don't really affect me
good
much.
Way to live, you know?
So, and truly, I am very sincerely affectionate of this company. It's,
mm.
it's something that people have a hard time understanding, and they tend to go, oh, you must hate General Motors for what they did. And
well, I think it's rather interesting. You drive today a Saturn.
I do. I drive
and reading,
a Saturn.
You know, some of your background, you've owned 8 Saturns.
I have.
So.
And this is my favorite one, actually. And I'm enough to, I mean, I have affinity for the company. I still have
mm-hmm.
lots of friends there. And that's been an interesting thing, too, because in all of this, in telling this story, we've never been anti-GM or
mm-hmm.
anti any of the corporations, really. We've taken issue with decisions and with certain people, but I've never said, hey, GM sucks.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that's in my nature, and I'm usually the lone person standing up
mm-hmm.
there on the stage saying, don't give up on them. I
mm-hmm.
think they can do better. Partially because I think they can, and I think all of them can.
Well, I think that they are. And
I think they are, too.
I mean, you know, I report on the company a lot, and I'm given access,
right.
which I don't take for granted. Some people will think that, oh, I'm just a paid mouthpiece for them, but I, you know, they don't require me to publish anything. They don't require pre-approval of anything that I put out there, so I'm certainly, you know, free in that regard. But, you know, they have something like 30 vehicles that get 30 miles to the gallon
yeah.
today, which is pretty incredible. They've announced the Volt,
mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. They've announced the plug-in hybrid, the Saturn
yeah.
View
mm-hmm.
Coming. And just the other day, I was in Santa Monica for their industry preview of the hybrid Yukon and hybrid Tahoe,
right,
which are getting now 20 miles per gallon city. They expect a 25% overall fuel improvement.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't released their highway numbers yet. They said just wait a little bit and we'll get those numbers to you.
Right.
But talk about that for a second. And that commitment from that company that you see, having been an insider, now being an outsider, if you will,
sure.
And particularly as it relates to SUVs and bringing a hybrid component to the most fuel inefficient vehicles out there on the road today.
Well, I think that GM, it's been a struggle for them. I know that they have long felt like they were doing more good than they were getting credit for. And I think that, you know, it's been a little bit of both. For sure, I think a lot of us would say that, you know, having a number of cars 30 miles a gallon isn't that much of an achievement when you have a Prius that's getting in the 50s. And that comparatively, they did let it go. That's part of what makes it so tough, is they had the lead and let it go.
Mm.
So it's hard to really, you know, be a cheerleader for 30 mile a gallon cars, much as a fleet, that might be a good thing, but they have always dragged in hybrids and other areas ever since they gave it up on the electric cars. And so, you know, especially our particular community has wanted to see them re-embrace that technology again. And they haven't done the best job, PR-wise, of embracing their past achievements. I mean, they have spent a lot of time trashing the electric car and marginalizing the people that loved them, and that's tough. I mean, it's very alienating. So I know that they struggle with what to do with it, and I watch them now. It's almost like, it's like watching your children a little bit. You know they have to go out and struggle a little bit. You watch them trying to do well, and you so badly want to step in and say, God, just let me help you here. Because I watched them try to embrace the EV1 for all that it was, and as the reason why they ought to be the leader on the Volt now, and yet to truly embrace it for all that it was begs the question of why'd you kill it? And I watched them struggle with how to handle some of those things. And they're clearly trying to do better, but it's tough to watch. I mean, you know, just a few weeks ago, Bob Lutz was trashing the EV1, the people that like it, those sorts of things. And you just want to go, you don't have to go there in order to make your point.
Yeah.
You know, and you need these people back. They'll be your cheerleaders again.
And it's funny because there seems to be a mutual antagonism. You know, here you've indicated Bob Lutz trashing the EV1 community, and, you know, there's people in the EV1 community who are equally, if not much more vociferous in their condemnation of General Motors.
Right.
And do you think that that, again, goes back to what you say about how hurt they were that that General Motors had the lead and they gave it up?
Oh, absolutely.
And they threw it away.
This
virtually
is a very emotional thing for both sides.
Mm.
And we tend not to assign emotion to companies, but there's as much emotion about all this within the companies as there are among the drivers and the enthusiasts and that sort of thing. There are a handful of people that will never be able to get back on board with GM, and one of them is incredibly vocal, and everybody else tends to be seen as just like him and held responsible for him in a certain way, which is unfortunate because the vast majority, I think, are willing to see them do better and would even come back. And, you know, I sort of have to repeat, you know, an idea is not responsible for the people who believe in it on both sides. And it is an emotional thing for GM. I think that some people within the company do feel they were unfairly maligned, whether it was by the movie or just in general. And there are others that absolutely agree. I get a lot of notes and phone calls and things that say, I can't be public, I need my job, but thank you for telling that story. I totally agree. And there's also there's been a lot of turnover. So there are a lot of people, and I think Bob Lutz is among them, who simply don't quite yet understand the passion. They see it, but they don't understand it. They weren't part of the program. They didn't see it in those days. And so they kind of come in after the fact and just don't get
why
they seem to be so passionate about,
you know,
a car.
I'm disappointed that I never got to drive one.
Yeah.
You know, and I certainly now will never get that opportunity.
Never say never. I keep hearing there are a few mules running around in Michigan.
Yeah? That's great.
But it's interesting. And you know, we have to keep in mind that had that car not been so good in the first place, and had GM not been so willing to be innovative and truly build the best thing possible, we wouldn't be telling the story today. Nobody would care if it hadn't been such a good car. So, you know,
do you think the Prius would even be around today if that car had not been built?
Probably not. Mm. I mean, it's possible. The PNGV program is really what created a lot of the hybrids, even though it really more embraced American hybrids at the time. And the Japanese kind of said, oh, God, this is inevitable. It's coming. We better get out and lead with this. So it wasn't directly tied to the original electric vehicles. However, I'm not sure that the PNGV program would have resulted had people not seen there was promise in electric drive. So a lot of things are kind of a confluence of several different events. But, you know, it's fair to say they probably wouldn't have taken as much of a chance on hybrids had that first way not been paved with electric cars.
I'm curious what you think might be a way for General Motors and the EV1 community to reconnect. You know, we've been talking about a vocal critic of General Motors, and he's very vocal about his criticism of General Motors, particularly as it relates to the Volt, saying that if the company were serious, they would reach out.
Right.
And you know, get this very passionate, committed group of early adopters on board with it. What do you think needs to happen in that space?
I think that certainly there needs to be some bridges built.
How?
Well, I mean, yes, communication is one of them. And I've watched, I think GM is trying to be much more communicative with this program than they historically have been. I mean, there have been several fairly open webcasts and conference calls and battery information sharing, different things that wouldn't have happened previously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that GM has learned some lessons about the past and about alienating different people, and that they're a little bit on the spot to produce this time. And so certainly communication would help, but I think that the vast majority in this group is a show me, not a talk to me group at this point.
Mm.
You know, until it's great, we're encouraged, we're optimistic, but until there's one in my driveway, you know, and I have a little bit of that too. You know, fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice. And even before we were willing to really get on board with the Volt announcements, you know, we sat down with a lot of people at GM and just sort of grilled them on the technology, but the motivations, and how are you going to handle this and that, and all of these different things, because even we wanted sort of evidence of sincerity and that sort of thing. So I think to a certain extent this group will come around, but they have to see action and progress before they do. I mean, there is still that emotion there, but you know, we do as a society embrace the underdog, and all of the Detroit auto manufacturers currently are underdogs. And it can't be overlooked that the only large manufacturer total to announce a plug-in car again has been GM, and they have announced two.
Yeah.
So, you know, even the perceived leaders, Honda and Toyota and those guys, have not announced a plug-in car. So we need to give credit to GM for that. But there is a little bit of, I'm not coming around just on a press release. You have to do something. You have to show me it.